Company of One, episode number 21. Hello and welcome to the Company of One and this 21st episode. This is Dale Callahan and I am your host. Today in the show, we're going to talk about something that probably a lot of you don't care about. Or at least you don't think you care about. And I'll tell you a little bit about it and you can make your call and save your time or not. Today I want to deal with the issue of the PhD. And what does it take to get a PhD, and who would be interested in getting a PhD, and why would you get a PhD? So if you're thinking, okay, this is not for me, let me throw some things out there real quick for you, and then you make your call. I mean, obviously, to get a PhD, you would need an undergraduate degree. You would need some kind of purpose and calling or reason to get a PhD, and it could be just a personal reason. As somebody told me the other day, I said, I would just like the sound of Dr. Fitzgerald. So, you know, whatever your motivation is. But think about for a moment that if you have that, a PhD is a separator in the sense that about 1% of the population has a PhD. And obviously, if you have some academic background or some technical background where you've been in academia some and you understand the process, it may be something that adds some value. As I look at the PhD, some of the things that I find is it does contribute. I mean, for beginners, you have that 1%, so you're separated. You're not you're a minority in a good way. It gives a level of excellence and experience, of credibility to you, whether it's true or not. It people assume that is there. A PhD can open up the doors of opportunity for things, and obviously in academia. But there's positions in corporate America that require PhDs. Now they're pretty good positions, the ones that I've looked at and the ones that I've been engaged in. That are strictly for PhDs. And there's more of them than you would think that are out there. And obviously in academia, there's a massive number of them. And depending on your area of what your expertise is. The other thing that happens with a PhD is people assume expertise of you that you may not have. It may be a false assumption. I know, and if you've listened to any of these things before, I talk about being a PhD, people assume you are the smartest person in the room. And I kid you not, over and over I find this. Now, that doesn't mean you're the smartest person in the room. And if you think you are the smartest person in the room, you got an ego problem that unfortunately a lot of PhDs do have. But it's probably not true, but people are going to assume that. I can be in with talking about some chemical processes and be surrounded by some chemical engineers, and people will, and I know nothing of chemistry. Let me be clear about this. But because I have the PhD, people will look at me and tell me, they'll look at me as the expert. You know, even though these other guys or gals will answer all the questions, they'll look at me as the expert because I have the PhD. Now, this is not true of everyone, obviously, and maybe you wouldn't do that. But over and over again, I find that to be true, sometimes almost to the point of being awkward. Now, I have found weird situations where I've gained the credibility. I remember sitting in a meeting where I'd worked with a group of people for a period of time, and this one individual who happened to be a lawyer, he was nice to me, but he really never gave me the time of day. But somebody came in and mentioned to me kind of, half jokingly, hey, professor, something like that, just a cordial tone because he and I knew each other. He too had a PhD. And this guy looked at me and said, you have a PhD. Our relationship changed instantaneously. Now, I'm not trying to say the guy's shallow or anything because he's not. But I think he looked at me differently. you know, that's, and it's not that I had done anything different, but he looked at me differently and he suddenly gave me a different level of respect. You know, and so people have opinions. Now, people also have opinions that PhDs are egotistical, worthless academics who have no touch with reality. And unfortunately, there are plenty of examples of just that. So you can get the mixed opinion of those. One thing is that when I deal with venture capital people, one of the things that I find investors are very cautious when they deal with three types of people. One is medical doctors, and another is lawyers, and another is PhDs. And the reason is because these three groups of people tend to be, as a group, egotistical, and they don't listen to counsel. They know everything. Now, if you're in any one of those three groups and you're trying to raise venture capital or something, and you're not getting anywhere because they assume that of you, and you're probably proving it to them that you are egotistical and don't listen to counsel. Obviously, there's lots of those people out there. And if you're listening to me saying this, and you're probably saying, well, you don't know what you're talking about. So obviously, again, egotistical and not listening to counsel. But, you know, I'm going to throw this out here, and so if these things don't interest you, let me throw one other caveat here to you, because I think this is going to be a short show. That's always a dangerous sign when somebody says they don't have much to say. That means this could go on for hours, but I don't think so. The one other thing is that may interest any of you is – I have many times told you or told my clients or told people that I counsel to find their calling, find their area of expertise. And one of those clues to your area of expertise is, what do other people ask your advice about? What do other people ask for your help, your counsel with? And one thing that's happening to me right now a lot is people asking me for help in getting the PhD. How would I do the PhD? What would I do? Will I be their advisor? And those kind of things, which clearly, if you've read any of my stuff or read the blogs or listened to the podcast, you understand that's an indicator of a level of expertise, and it's also an indicator of possible products and services. And what may be happening to you, like it's happening to me in this particular area, is you get a little overwhelmed of answering the question over and over and over and over again. So you need to process it. You need to build some mechanism to answer the question to help people. You want to help people, but you have a limited amount of time just to sit there and go to lunches and talk on the phone and answer emails. You have a limited amount of time to do that for free. Or even for paid, you know, and I've been paid to do this kind of stuff where people are paying for my counsel, but you still have a limited amount of time you can do. And so what you do is you build a product. So what I am in the process of right now of a couple of products that I'm working on, one of them is the pain-free PhD. And it's going to teach people how to get a PhD. Because one thing I've recognized is that people get into the PhD process and they spend thousands upon thousands of dollars and years. They spend that extra time and money and they didn't have to. So part of what I'm trying to do is help people close that gap, help them save that money, help them save that time. And I'm not even going to deal with opportunity cost right now. But you realize it's a valuable asset if I can teach people how to close the gap. Now, when I go out there and I look, and there's a whole bunch of books out there on how to get a PhD and what to do, and you know, quite honestly, they're trivial stuff. They're the non-important stuff. They're written by academics for academics. What I like to do is teach people a process that works. It's corporate, if you will. It's functional. Gets results, you know. That's, you know, it's, and maybe like a Dave Ramsey baby steps. It's focus on the end game and get to the results that you want. So why might you want to listen if you're looking at a PhD Or if you're looking at, hey, people keep asking me for help and how do you create a product? How do you do this? So that's what I'm talking through right now. This is free advice. So if you're looking for a – and by the way, this advice works. And what you're going to find here posted in the show notes and posted in the audio is the advice that works. And for the rest of the detail, obviously, you're paying for it. It's fair because I can guarantee you I can save you thousands upon thousands of dollars in getting your PhD. And that's exactly how my product will be laid out. That will be the pitch. And so here's – let me kind of walk you through the process and the product then. So if you're – if all of this turns you off so far, then turn it off. Go listen to another podcast. Go listen to your favorite podcast or your favorite radio station or something like that. But, you know, if you want to hear this out – and because kind of we're doing the both things. We're advising people on the PhD and looking at how do you create a product. So let's get started. Let me first give you some what a PhD is and what it's not and kind of walk you through the very, very high level process. And first let's talk process. Let's say you want to get a PhD. Now, for a PhD is nothing but obviously it's an advanced degree, the most advanced degree for most people, that that you get after you have an undergraduate or bachelor's degree. Now, a lot of people assume you have to have a master's degree to get a PhD, but that's not true. And it depends on your programs, and every single program is different. Now, I don't mean every university. I mean every program, every department, every program. So a PhD in computer science versus a PhD in computer engineering, which might be offered by the same department in the same school. But they're two different programs, two different tracks, two different sets of requirements. And that's, you know, one of the things everyone's going to be a little different, but they all generally fall into these categories that – they look at first your undergraduate degree. Okay, you've got to have that requirement. For most people, this is absolute requirement because of accreditation issues, which you care nothing about at this point in time. But after you've got the undergraduate degree and you now want to pursue a PhD, what they look at is everything, every course, everything that you've ever done past the undergraduate, practically speaking, coursework in your field. But all of that past the undergraduate counts. So if you've been working on a master's, if you're a computer science person and you've been working on some master's and you kind of hem-hawed around and did a few courses in programming or, you know, whatever it be in that's related to the field, and you want to get a PhD in computer science, those courses that you took where you were playing around count. They should count. They can count. If you went off and you got an MBA, those courses can count, should count, or at least some of them, towards your PhD in computer science. If you went off and got a master's degree in basket weaving, well, that may be a bit tougher challenge. But, yeah, I mean, you get the idea. What they're looking at is they're looking at any coursework, any academic material that you have after the undergraduate. Now, we might be able to count industrial experience, such as if you've gone through corporate training or things like this and you've developed expertise that we can validate by testing. We won't get into that too much now, but really that's what you're looking at is, so I can go into a PhD program, and most people I work with, they have a master's degree or they may have multiple master's degrees, maybe an MBA. In our case, we have the IEM, the Engineering Masters of Engineering. We might have a master's in English, you know. So you might have kind of a combination of things, or you might just have, hey, I've picked up one or two courses along the way. Because what's required usually for a PhD is the undergraduate degree and then X number of credit hours of courses. Let's just pretend it's going to be 34 credit hours of coursework. And this means courses. You sign up, you go take the class, you sit through it, or you work independently with a professor, whatever. It's a course. It has a syllabus. It has a beginning. It has an end. And there's some grade you get, A, B, C, D, or F. Most graduate schools don't count Ds. But anyway, you take a course. Yeah, you know how to do this. And then the next process is, after you're finished with that, you form a committee, which starts with a committee chair, which is your advisor. And this is usually a 5 people or 6 people. Anyway, they're academics that sit on the committee. And your advisor is your primary person that you're working with. And, you know, in the ideal sense, they're the one that has the research topic that you want to work under and you want to learn under and you want to mentor you and all that kind of wonderful stuff that's usually, well, that's usually just crap. It doesn't work that way. In theory, that's how it would work. And then supposedly the other people on your committee offer expertise in their area. That's usually garbage too. The reality from the university point of view is the committee is there to keep you and the chair on you and the chairman of the committee honest, that there's a process to follow. There's certain requirements for a PhD, and they're fuzzy. They're a bit fuzzy. But they're there to help keep people honest so that I don't just get, because me and you are buddies and I get you through a PhD, and just slapping you on the back and say, you pay your money and you can get the PhD. And, you know, it's accountability. And that's primary. Now they may add value to you and your subjects and things like that. And theoretically they will, but primarily it's accountability, and it's accountability to you, and it's people to question you. And it gives you the challenge of convincing 5 independent academics, that you're convincing all of them at once that you've done work that's valuable of a PhD. That right there is the key to the PhD. Convincing 5 independent units or 6, however many you have on your committee, you want the minimum number you have to get, for the reason more personalities does not make better process. So you want the minimum number you can get, and your job is to convince them that what you've done is PhD-level work. That sounds simple enough. So, but what you're doing after your coursework is you get this committee, and then the first thing you do is you get a research topic. I'm going to research this. And you present to the committee a proposal. And the proposal says, hey, I'm going to research this, and when I'm done, I'm going to have objective 1, 2, 3, 4 done. I'm going to do these very, 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 very specific things, and it's going to get about that granular. I'm going to do very specific things, and this is what my dissertation or my research is going to accomplish. And obviously, when you present the proposal, you're saying, everybody up to now has done this research. Now, I'm going to use an example for somebody I have got doing this right now, and he's a marathon runner. He's an IM alumni, one of our graduate program alumni. He's a marathon runner. He is interested in social media. So what his general high-level topic is, how do you rate marathons? In other words, is it good, bad, terrible, whatever? How do you rate it based upon social media data, in particular Twitter data, where, you know, I'm dealing with human – I mean, how do I automate this process? But since there's marathons all over the world, there's lots of people talking about them on Twitter. How do you figure out what the human language means when there's 140 characters and I might shortcut it? When there's emotions expressed, how can I figure out whether the emotions are good, positive, or negative? So I'm looking at a rating system where I'm not asking people to rate on a scale of 1 to 5, but I'm trying to suck out information based upon what they've said on Twitter. Now that sounds, you know, when he first came up with this idea, it sounded trivial. But where he's at right now is he's writing this proposal I'm talking about, and he's really drilling down. So what he's having to do is say, here's all the research that's been done in the past. Here's the marathons in the world, and here's how many people are talking about them on Twitter, and here's here's the various kinds of languages there are in Twitter. There's hashtags, and there's emotions expressed, or emoticons, if you will. There's location data. There's facts expressed. There's chat, you know, stuff that has nothing to do. What he's got to do is he's got to parse out what all kinds of information are in there, because, again, he's going to automate it. And then he's got to figure out what to do with those kinds of pieces of information, and so that he develops a model. So one of his first objectives is to do all this background research. Now, there's a lot more words in his description, but that's basically what he's doing. I'm doing all the background. What is the state of art of rating models for social media? His second objective is to build a model to rate marathons. Now, by the way, model is not software, which is part of the scope creep that a lot of people end up with. But it's to build a model, you know, is what's the inputs and outputs look like and what's the magic in between. And the third thing is, how is he going to validate the model? Okay, I've built this model and I rate the Boston Marathon as a 4 out of 5. How do I validate what I got against other mechanisms, other rating systems that people accept, you know, Yelp data or Boston Marathon survey data or whatever? How do I rate these things? I mean, how does it compare? In other words, I'm testing my model. Does my model work? So whether that's his objectives or not, but that's three objectives. So you kind of see how we went from the high level to three specific things. Now, his are going to be even more specific and more precise, because as you get into researching, that's how it works. So as he does this, he now will present all this to a committee. And the committee will say, yes, when you've done those three things and based upon all the coursework you've done to date and when you've done all this, and let us ask you some questions and validate it. And sometimes we consider that the qualifying exam. They might say, let us give you a test. It's up to the committee, by the way. They might say, let the test be oral. Let us just ask you a bunch of questions. They might say, here's a take-home test. Go do this for the next month. It's totally up to the committee. So then you get the information. But the point being, they get the information. They get satisfied that this PhD person is going to do what he says, and it's going to add value. Now, once he does that, he is signed off. And what happens is, this committee of 5 people usually agree. When you're done with that, when you do everything you said you're going to do, you will earn the PhD. And they sign off on it. Now, that is a written legal contract. At this point, when they sign off, you move from a PhD student to what they call a candidate. So it sounds trivial, but it's a change in status. Your status is, you're now a PhD candidate. You're done with everything else. Your committee's happy with it. Your committee's happy with your plan. They've signed off, and you now have a contract. When I go off and I do this and I do what I said I was going to do, you now must give me a PhD. It's a must. It's a legal binding, and yes, it is binding, and it has been in court. It's a legal binding contract between the university and you as the individual. And we call that the proposal process. So you've taken a bunch of courses. You've done a proposal. You don't have to do them necessarily in that order, but this is the typical order. And after that, what you do is the magic. You write the dissertation, which means you do those 3 or 4 or 5 objectives you said you were going to do. And you go and write it, give it to the committee, present it. Sounds easy enough. And actually, people think, well, that's a pretty easy process. You know, I don't really know what I'm going to do, but that sounds pretty easy and trivial. That's the hard part, because the reality is, you're alone doing it. People always think that, hey, their advisor is going to be there. Even this guy I'm working with, he thinks that I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be helping him along the way. Now, really, all I'm going to do is challenge him. And I'm fairly engaged in the process. But you might find that your advisor, your main PhD committee member, doesn't talk to you at all. You're really alone. As a matter of fact, that is not atypical. That you're alone. It's up to you. They don't care when you're done. They don't care if you're ever done. It's no skin off of their back if you don't finish. Okay? And that's the bad, dangerous side. And this is where all this activity that you've, if you're a Brian Tracy fan or any of these people who are task managers or managing priorities and how to get things done, you know, those, you know, David Allen getting things done. This is where all this time management, productivity stuff comes in, because it's up to you to do it. There's no boss hanging on your, you know, there's no boss hanging over you. There's no paycheck attached to it. There's nothing. There's nobody pushing you through each incremental step. It's up to you. Totally, 100% up to you. Now, if you happen to find yourself with a committee member or a chairman who pushes you and helps you. It's very, very unusual. And if you happen to find yourself meeting a committee member that promises they will do that, they're probably lying through their teeth. They may have the best intentions of the world of doing it. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. So that's the general PhD process. Now, let me kind of tell you what I find to work really, really well in this process. And I discovered, and then by the way, you know, okay, I'm giving you the process, giving this. So now people come and ask me this, and they ask me for my advice. And this goes going back to your expertise and your calling and those kind of things. They ask me my advice for this. And the reason they ask me is, number one, I have a PhD, which is kind of critical. You have to have lived what they're trying to live. But why am I an expert is because some people have learned that I did my PhD. Now, it took me a long time, partly because I didn't do anything. But what happened is I tell this story a lot of times when I'm teaching people to set goals. I'll talk about goal setting, and I say, you know, for a long time I had been done with all my coursework, and all I needed to do was a dissertation, go convince, write a proposal, go convince a committee, and do all that kind of stuff. But I'd done all my coursework. Which is where people get, they've done all their coursework and they think they're done. Very few people. Go back and read the post on does it pay to get a PhD, and you'll see the stats on that. But most people don't finish even though they're done with their coursework. But I had gotten done, and I sat and I'd done a bunch of research, and I did this. And in years, it sat there in my basement or my office doing nothing. I mean, literally, I was doing nothing. And as we were making a move from one house to another, I told my wife, you know, I'm going to throw this stuff away because I'm not going to do this. This is stupid. I don't need to do this. Money is not the issue. And she just looked at me and she said, you're an idiot. Now, for the disclaimer, you know, I always tell people that she says I'm an idiot, and she says she never says that. But that's what I heard. That's my translation. So that's I'm going with that. Now, she told me the only thing standing between you and a PhD is to write a stupid paper. And I remember being taken aback. Like, I've never heard anybody refer to a dissertation as a stupid paper. And I kind of thought about that a minute. And I thought, well, that's really all it amounts to, is it's a stupid paper. Okay. So I committed at that very point. I mean, that's the number one thing is obviously if you know anything about goal setting, I committed to make it happen. I set a plan out. And this is – I tell people this in the goal setting, and you'll find some of my posts. I'll try to find that and put that in the show notes. Make myself a note right here about that. But I do as I teach people about goal setting – I teach them the first thing is do the commitment and then kind of go and set some time in your schedule to do it. I set between 7 and 9 in the morning every day, a 2-hour window that I would work on it and figure out what the steps are. It's kind of the Zig Ziglar approach to goal setting. You know, what's my obstacles in my way and go kill them. What had happened, I started in July, and by September, I was so far, I was practically done with the dissertation. I had done the rough draft. I'd written a massive amount. I'd done the major part of the research. And I was so far ahead of the game, the committee and the university, I had bypassed all the systems that hold you back in the academia, if you will. But I had done the hard part. I had done the absolute hardest part, which is the inertia, getting past the inertia. And literally, I was pretty much done. I remember when I gave my proposal to my committee, which was probably that September, after you know, I told them, look, here's what I'm proposing, but let's just be frank, I've already done all this. You know, and it was kind of a dangerous statement to say because they could have said, well, if you've already done it, you got to do something else. But they didn't. They went along with me. I had some good committee members. So here I was. Here I am. I'm telling this to people as goal setting, and what happens now is the reason people ask me for advice is they recognize I have expertise. Number one, I have the PhD, and number two, I've told them about my process. Okay, I have a process that works. I discovered it somewhat accidentally, but I have a process that works, and so people come and they seek me out now. again, even if you're not interested in a PhD and you're trying to find your calling, that's the key, is you're looking at developing products and services. What have you found that you have a process that works and you have expertise and people are asking you for help? You have products and services there. So I'm going to walk you really quick through my process that I'm going to use. And this is probably the key parts of our product, The Ultimate Guide to the Pain-Free PhD. And this is, obviously there's details and there's lots of details. But with what I'm telling you right now, this will work. So let me give you the first caution. If you try to do what I'm suggesting to do, you will find resistance. It will be big. You will find people telling you that you can't do it this way, this doesn't work. You will find people telling you that you can't understand what topic you want to research until you've taken a certain number of courses and you have some legwork behind you. You'll find people telling you can't move this fast. You'll find all of these things to be true, and they're all lies. I mean, you'll find all people saying this, but they're all lies. You can move fast. You can be very aggressive. And by the way, some of the people giving that advice will be other PhD students. So you're going to be up against a system. But the first thing you want to do before you get into the program, now I'm not going to worry about at this point of what kind of program, but let's say you're going to get a PhD, and let's say you've picked a subject, you've picked a university, you've picked a department, you've picked a program. Go talk to all the faculty before you take any course, maybe even before you sign up for the program. Go talk to all the faculty. And what you're looking at, and of course you want some idea of what you want to research. So let's pick on the gentleman I was talking about. He had this idea that he wanted to do something with marathons because he enjoys marathons and social media. Now, he actually had a couple other subjects too, but we picked on those subjects, by the way, because that's what he was passionate about. Some of his other subjects they were boring. Let's just be frank. They were boring to me. What you want to do is you want to kind of get your general subject and go talk to all the faculty. And I would talk to all of them on the phone, on email, in person preferably. And what you're looking for is that kindred spirit, somebody who gets excited about your idea, somebody who seems like they would be helpful in that idea, somebody who seems like they know how to publish, that's key, somebody who seems like they don't want to make you a lifelong slave in the process. Now, what you're looking for is keywords. You're looking for long periods of time. You're looking for, and I would just be frank asking, how long do you think it will take me to get a PhD and do this dissertation? If they tell you 10 years, walk away. If they tell you, I had this exact situation. Somebody told me it was going to take me 6 months. And this was in June before that July, after my wife had slapped me around a little bit. In June, I went and talked to some faculty, and they said, hey, this is probably going to take you 6 months working 40 hours a week of dedicated work just to get your head around the subject before you can begin. I'm sitting there calculating, 6 months, that's December. No, thank you. I mean, and that's the kind of thing you want to learn and listen for. Now, I'm not saying this gentleman wouldn't have been very wonderful to work with, and I'm not discounting what he was saying, but I'm saying that didn't work for me in my plan, because I walked out of that, I found something else to do, I found somebody else to work with. By July I started, and by September I was practically done. Under his plan, by December I would practically been able to begin. And just because that's his nature of long periods of time and very iterative processes, I would have been at least 2 more years in the process. I just know that's how it would have worked. And I know that individual, and that's how it would have worked. I didn't want that, and it wasn't for me. So that's what you first have. You want to get done, and you want to get done quickly, as quickly as possible. You want to find that individual who likes the subject, who you get the sense that they will help you get done quickly, and they will not put up false barriers. How do you find that? You listen for clues. And don't get sucked into just something they say. Yeah, I like to get my people out as quick as possible. You know, maybe even talk to them about what other PhDs they've worked with and talk to those individuals who have done PhDs with them. I can tell you right now, if you do that, you could get some nightmare stories that I never thought I was going to graduate. So that's what you want to get to, is you want to find that kindred spirit. From that, you know, once you find that person to work with, you want to get a topic as fast as possible. You want to define your topic. Now, how do you do that? You chat with them about it, and you try to narrow it down. But what you want to do is do a literature review. So in this case, I'm going to just pick on his marathons, social media. You go out and you search everything under scholarly. You know, your library, you probably have a librarian who's an expert in academic research. This is not Google articles. This is not Time magazine articles. This is scholarly research. So you're looking for every paper, every academic publication that talks about your subject. And you want to, I mean, in my case, and in your case, I'd probably do the same thing. I'd print them out because they're probably 2 or 3 page papers, maybe 5 page papers. They may be book chapters. They may be some Google articles that offer something. You want to get it and stack it together and try to start making sense of the data. Because what you're looking at, the magic to coming up with your specific topic and your specific objectives is to try to make sense of all the massive amount of data. Can you put it into a table? If you've ever bought software and you've looked up reviews on CRM software or something and you find these little charts where they have them all and they rate them by cost and tech support and all these rating systems, that's what you're looking for, is how many different ways can you compare and categorize the data? I mean, what we're talking about is the data that's already out there. And by doing that, you've created a literature review. And what you're doing is saying the background of everything that's been written in my subject is this. Now, obviously, this is where getting a more narrow, less researched subject is better. If you're trying to do research on writing good software, you'll have generated 10 million papers to print. In this guy's case, oddly enough, on rating systems on Twitter, not that many. There's a lot written about Twitter, but not to do real rating systems with Twitter. So he's probably got 20, 30, maybe 40 papers at max. So that's just part of the process, is you're trying to sift down to where you can get to somewhere where you can add value, where you can pick on a problem that you can add value. In that literature review, and what it took me a while to get him to do was start writing a paper, start summarizing what you found, start writing about your goals and objectives. And he told me the other day, he said, that's just magical. When you start writing, it starts to become clear, because this is a muddled mess when you begin. So, but that's where you want to start. And by the way, you're doing this immediately. And if you're smart, what you can do is work with your major professor or your advisor and say, hey, I want to sign up for you in my first term for a special topics course or a research course, whatever they want to call it, where you are doing the work I'm talking about right now. So your output from the work will be a literature review. You'll take that literature review and you'll write a paper where you summarize, in this guy's case, you know, I'm going to summarize all the Twitter social media rating algorithms in one paper and talk about the pros and cons of each. And I'm not really adding any value, except I'm summarizing in a clear, concise thing. So there is intellectual property there. So I'm writing that first paper. I'm taking the background of the material, and I submit that paper. And by the way, that paper becomes the proposal. I mean, it's formatted differently. So, and this, by the way, what I do with the people I work with on a PhD, and I've got 3 I'm working with right now, is I require them. This is a requirement. If you're going to work with me, you must take a course with me the very first term, and it's going to be called a special topics in whatever, where you're going to, number one, define the topic. You're going to do your literature review. You're going to write the first paper, the background material, and you're going to submit it to a conference. You're going to write the proposal. As I just said, it's very similar material. And you're going to form your committee. There's 5 objectives I've got for people that are working with me. And they must do this in the very first term. Now, why does this work? And by the way, what I just told you is the key. Why that works, why this process works, is because the big danger of the PhD and the thing that takes forever is getting the idea and getting it clear in your head. What the process I just walked you through, and it may be a little unclear to you yet until you're a PhD, until you understand it, but the process I just walked you through unmuddles the process. It forces you to come up with a topic quickly. Now, what happens? Let's say I got to take 27 credit hours of coursework. I'm already working on my dissertation. And that means if I'm taking a course in C programming for databases, I don't know, I'm just making something up, then I start to think about C programming for databases as it applies to Twitter. And so what happens is I take that course, I write a paper in that course that goes toward my dissertation. So, I mean, that's the whole point. The whole point is the dissertation. So let's make everything that you do in the PhD program build toward the dissertation. Let's not wait till you feel like you're halfway through to start on the main goal. The main goal is the dissertation. Now, if you're not a PhD person and you're like, I don't have a clue what the heck you just said, Dale. As a matter of fact, if you are a PhD person, you may be a little fuzzy on it until you really have to wrestle with it. And it is a struggle, I'll be honest. But if you're not, I hope you understand and see what I'm doing here. As I'm walking people through two different things, and that's number one is to teach them to focus on the goal. The goal is not academic work. The goal is the dissertation. And number two is I'm teaching them a process that I know works. Now, obviously, there's details to the process I can't cover in 40 or 50 minutes, but I know this process works. And I can show them how to do it. I can show them examples of it. I can show them what it looks like. And once they get started, they'll have all these aha moments and it will start to click, just like in anything else we do. You know, there's nothing, even driving a car, you know, it's simple for me to sit here and describe, but there's, if you haven't done it before, it doesn't sound so simple. And it's not till you start to get behind the wheel of the car and then you listen to the advice that your parents gave you as you're trying to drive and then it starts to click. You start to understand, and the more you do it, the more you understand, and the more you do it, the more you understand what they've taught you. You know, and that's the process. And if you're an expert, and by the way you are, whatever you teach people, that's going to be the same way. Whatever you teach people, you're going to add value to them by showing them a process. And it may be a simple thing, or it may be something more complex, like getting a PhD. But the point is, I can add value. Now, the point in this case, I can add value. I can literally save people thousands upon thousands of dollars in years. Of time and effort of not getting anywhere. So, I mean, we're talking about, so just to think about the product here, where a book on getting a PhD, which most of them I've read is kind of garbage, might cost you $30. But I'm guaranteeing people to save them $10,000. So how much is this worth? It's probably going to save them, you know, it probably will save about that, $10,000. You know, so, and I'm not saying that to say what my price point is. I'm not sure I know that yet. But you get the idea. This is the value I am adding to people by offering a simple process that works. What about you? You know, what about your expertise? That's the kind of thing that you want to think of. And that's, by the way, some of our other products that we'll be offering in October will teach you just how to develop that authority expertise that we're talking about to put products on the market. Well, I hope this is, even if you're not the PhD person, I hope this is of value to you. If you are the PhD person, hey, let me know. Let me know what you're thinking about working on, where, what university, who you're doing something with. I mean, I love to hear the stories, the struggles, because obviously there's going to be some. You know, I'd be glad to hear and be glad to help you in any way, you know, and help direct this process, and maybe, you know, if you got questions about the process and how it works, you know, feel free to ask me a question. You can reach me at Dale Callahan. At Dale. The email address is Dale at DaleCallahan.com or on Twitter, Dale Callahan, Facebook, Dale Callahan. Wow, seems to be a trend there. Ask questions. I get a lot of emails. I got probably a lot more emails than we do stuff on Twitter and Facebook and comments to blogs. You know, every now and then people comment on blogs. So in any way you want. And there's also, I get from time to time, the questions on the SpeakPipe. If you go to DaleCallahan.com and go to the right, there's the SpeakPipe that you can actually leave a message. It's kind of like a voicemail from your computer. It's really kind of cool. This is on iTunes. This is on, you can get it on DaleCallahan.com. This is episode number 21. And, you know, please feel free. I encourage you, if you find this useful, to subscribe to us on iTunes, to give us feedback. As I've told many people before, the reason for giving feedback is obviously for me. I mean, especially if you have something that's wonderful to say, you know, that, hey, we all like that. And if you have constructive feedback, hey, I need that, you know, something that tells me something to do better. But also feedback is the more important part, is it helps other people decide, is this for them? Is this useful for them? And I'm not saying that about my stuff as much as I'm saying it about everything on Amazon books you buy, on blogs you read, on products you buy. I bought something at Lowe's the other day that was, less than a stellar product. And, you know, so I need to go back and write a review so people know, don't waste your time and money. Lowe's sells lots of good products. That is not one of them. So, you know, people need to know that. And I read these reviews and you read these reviews. So why aren't you sharing your expertise? And that right there, sharing your expertise and what you know and what you've experienced with people. Offer value to people. Thank you so much for your time. Now I just implore you, go make something happen. And what you find out?